Welcome to Three Women, Three Ways. We're a show that usually tackles some pretty socially liberal topics. Let's just put it that way. And I think that many of our guests are psychologists and educators and people that we tend to think of as being pretty liberal in their usual thinking. Not always, but we tend to generalize that way. And today we have a different take on our social justice topics. I'm talking with Dave Workman, who is with the Second Amendment Foundation, and we're going to be talking Second Amendment. Welcome, Dave.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Yes, I think that some of our listeners would be surprised that we're talking about gun rights and gun owners' rights, but that's what we're going to do today. We particularly are interested in the issues of safety and, for example, around domestic violence, and we're going to be tackling that. But first of all, tell me about the Second Amendment Foundation. What does it do? What does it stand for? And what do you do with the Second Amendment Foundation?
Well, the Second Amendment Foundation has been around for more than 40 years. It was founded by a man named Alan Gottlieb, who is the executive vice president now. It has concentrated solely on education and litigation, and in terms of litigation, it's been pretty successful. The Second Amendment Foundation was responsible for the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court case, McDonald v. City of Chicago, that not only nullified that city's handgun ban, but it also incorporated the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution to the states via the 14th Amendment. If your listeners do a little bit of homework, they'll find that I think it's 40 states, maybe it's 42 states, have specific state constitutional right to keep and bear arms provisions in their state constitution. Washington state has one, Oregon, Idaho. You'll find that they've got pretty solid provisions in those constitutions to protect the individual citizen's right to have a firearm. Ours was adopted in November of 1889 when Washington achieved statehood, and apparently it was so successful that the state of Arizona, when it became a state in 1912, adopted our provision word for word in their state constitution.
Wow. Did they pay us for that?
Well, I don't know. I never saw any money, but
Well, I know that we're both mature, shall we say, but I don't think you were around in that at that era, were you?
Well, I don't know. Some people accuse me of being around that long, but no, I came along a little bit later.
I always say I'm older than dirt now. That's just how old I am now. Older than dirt.
Well, I get to tell people that I've got a pair of boots that's older than they are. So, and usually that sticks.
Well, my father-in-law always used to say, "But I'm so old that I no longer buy green bananas."
Smart guy.
Yeah. So anyway, okay. So now that we've established our creds as being old farts, let's move on and finish talking about the Second Amendment. What you're describing is stuff that happened years ago. And I think the general opinion of most people, well, you and I, although our show is worldwide, you and I happen to live in an area that is considered to be particularly liberal. And along with that liberal, and I know I'm going to be getting emails here, and that's okay. You can take me to task for this. But typically the liberals are the ones that are saying, oh, it's not good to have a gun. You can't have a gun. No, bad. Guns are always bad. And in Washington State, we have some litigation going on right now that the Second Amendment Foundation is working on. And it's in an area where we have this really strong prejudice against guns, all guns, any gun. Am I characterizing that correctly, or am I just wildly generalizing?
Well, a little bit of both. I know some. Well, I'm a newsman. See, you know, whatever else I do, I'm a journalist, and I've even got a diploma from the University of Washington that says I graduated from the School of Communications. That said,
you graduated from a Wussy School of Communications because I graduated from Kent State University with a journalism degree.
So do I have a journalism degree. Same thing.
You just said it was a degree in communication.
Well, it's a journalism degree. School of Communications is the journalism. So let's not mince words, and you know, we'll knock off the debate and you know. The thing that I think needs to be put in perspective is that I know a lot of liberals who have guns, and they're fairly zealous about it, although there are occasions when some of those folks think that, well, I've got my gun, but maybe Joe over there shouldn't have one.
Because Joe is not as good as I am.
Well, yeah, something like that. You know, we're going back to Animal Farm, but remember, when you get right down to cases, we're talking about a constitutionally enumerated fundamental right. Now, that's not me talking. It's not the Second Amendment Foundation talking. That's the U.S. Supreme Court talking. And there's a lot of history behind that. I think if you look at the state constitutions, you'll get even a better understanding why this is an individual right protecting every citizen's right to be able to defend themselves. A lot of people think that the Second Amendment may be passé, it may be an anachronism, but I think it's just as important today as it was 237 years ago. When it was ratified as part of the Bill of Rights, it's just as important as, say, the First Amendment or the Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, Ninth, and Tenth Amendments that are all part of the Bill of Rights. And it has been treated, I think, as a second-class right for far too long. The Supreme Court in the last decade has only decided two cases, both of them affirmative, protecting the Second Amendment as an individual right. So that we need to keep in perspective. The lawsuit that you're alluding to is a challenge by the Second Amendment Foundation and the National Rifle Association of Initiative 1639, which was adopted by voters in November 2018. That initiative essentially stripped Second Amendment rights away from young adults in Washington state, those 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. Says they can't buy any kind of a semi-automatic rifle. They can still join the military, where we issue them a fully automatic rifle. If they're in the infantry, we allow 18-year-old and 19 and 20-year-olds to get married, to enter into contracts, to vote. To do all of that stuff, which they're considered, I guess, mature enough to do, but they're not mature enough to handle a firearm, or at least buy a semi-automatic firearm, which I think is a gross injustice to those young people. I bought my first gun in Washington State when I was 19, and it wasn't a semi-automatic, but I still purchased the firearm, and I don't think anything really has changed that much in all those years. I had a right to do it, and the young people today have the same rights. We can't be picky about which rights we allow somebody to enjoy. You either have them or you don't. So that case is in U.S. District Court. Just a few days ago, the judge in that case allowed the case to move forward. It had been challenged by the defendants on the grounds that the plaintiffs didn't have standing. Well, the plaintiffs do have standing. All the plaintiffs, in addition to NRA and SAF, there are two firearms retailers as plaintiffs in that case, one in Spokane and one in Vancouver, and four young adults, two of whom that I know tried to purchase firearms and were turned away because they were under age 21. So that makes them injured parties, and then certainly that gives them standing in the case.
So this case, in the initiative 1639 that you referred to, made it legal in this state for you to purchase any of these constitutionally legal or any legal firearms if you're not 21. Is that right?
What it prohibits is the purchase of any semi-automatic rifle in the state of Washington by anybody in that age group. And I think what's more important, or certainly equally important, is language in the initiative classified literally every semi-automatic rifle that's ever been manufactured as a semi-automatic assault rifle. That includes small game rifles, you know, 22 caliber rifles that kids use to learn how to shoot, that they've been, you know, used in competition. I own one that I use to hunt small game with, and I do a lot of recreational shooting with that rifle. So what you've got is a situation of, I think, extreme overkill. And unfortunately, the voters bought into that, thinking that, gee whiz, this is going to result in a reduction of crime. It's going to prevent crime. If you look at the FBI uniform crime reports for Washington State, historically, rifles of any kind have been used in a fraction of the homicides in this state, as well as nationally. Anywhere from 2 to 4% of all the homicides in any given year are committed with rifles of any kind, and that includes bolt action, lever action, semi-automatic, single shots. So it really doesn't make sense to me as a journalist who writes about this stuff to go after a type of firearm that is used in a very small number of crimes in this country.
But that's what we do, don't we? We go after the minority. We make the rules for the minorities. We make the prohibitions based on what the minorities do. I mean, that's what we have a long history of doing in this country. Why should it be different for weapons?
Well, shame on us, I guess, as a nation. You know, we're a republic. We're not a democracy, and a republic is designed to protect the rights of the minority against the tyranny of the majority, or vice versa, protect the rights of the majority against the tyranny of a loud minority. So it shouldn't work that way. Unfortunately, it has over the course of years. You know, you pick any given subject, I guess you'll find somebody who has a grievance, and a lot of times those grievances are valid, especially when it comes to regulating a constitutionally protected right. You know, this isn't a privilege, it is a right, and if anybody doesn't understand the difference, they really need to sit down and go back through their high school civics books and understand a little bit more about what rights are and what privileges are.
Well, I think that's the crux of the problem, isn't it? Two things from what you've been saying. One is, I think when we hear the words semi-automatic, people who don't know firearms, people who don't know how weapons are made, automatically assume that you're talking some sort of Rambo something or other with semi-automatic. But as you pointed out, there are everyday target shooting and small game, you know, weapons that are considered semi-automatic as opposed to fully automatic, right?
Well, yeah, and I think part of this is the fault of Hollywood, and another part of it is the fault of the mainstream press. You know, my colleagues in the media are all too often pretty much gun stupid. They really don't understand what they're reporting about, talking about. I occasionally get phone calls over here from colleagues of mine from, you know, all over the country asking me questions about, hey, Dave, you know, this is your beat. Tell me about this. And I will. I consider that just a professional courtesy. And hopefully it helps them write a better story that's got more credibility to it. But if you look at some of the entertainment that we've had over the years and some of the the misidentification of firearm types, people confuse semi-automatics with full auto machine guns. And unfortunately, there's not a lot I can do as an individual. I write about that stuff, but you know, I'm up against maybe years, if not decades, of misinformation out there. You know, people who just don't understand the difference. And you know, what they're talking about mainly are AR-15s that have never been used in combat that I know of. They're the civilian version of an M16 or now the M4 type firearms that you see in the military today. The AR-15 is a semi-automatic rifle. I know people that hunt with them. There's a lot of competition that goes on involving AR-15s because they were the civilian knockoff of the service rifle that a lot of the guys from, say, even the Vietnam era forward learned to shoot with. And they grew up with these guns, and they like them. I don't have a problem with them. I don't own one, but I've shot a lot of them, and some of them are remarkably accurate. I know people who shoot coyotes with them and use them to contend with predators on their farm and ranch lands in eastern Washington and even farther east into Montana. Guys shoot prairie dogs with them. They even have something called zombie matches, which I think is it's an offshoot of a bunch of TV shows that have The Walking Dead and all of that. And you know, they have targets that I guess if you shoot a zombie, you get a certain score or something. I don't know how that works, but apparently it's a lot of fun and it attracts a lot of people. So, you know, there's really nothing wrong or different between the people who own AR-15s and somebody who likes to shoot skeet or trap or hunts with a semi-auto shotgun, just like Grandpa did. They all work pretty much the same, and if somebody has a house full of them, I don't care. It's none of my business. You know, if he's a responsible gun owner and he's not committing crimes with them, who cares? I certainly don't.
Well, but I think there are a lot of people who do care because they associate gun ownership with massive school shootings or massive crimes. I found it interesting that I was just reading some headlines yesterday or the day before, and there were 12 schoolgirls that were seriously injured and two that were killed, and the bus driver was killed, in Tokyo because some mad guy went on a rampage with a knife.
Yeah,
and, yet,
and
I
you know, that's it's
I
an interesting...
arguing to, you know, let's control knives. Let's make sure the only people who have knives are people who we've screened and we know are normal. And, you know, I mean, I never hear that.
Well,
people seem
there's a problem with that, too, because you never hear that called knife violence. and you're right. People don't seem to associate that with the same degree of angst as they do firearms. And really, you know, at the risk of sounding a little too blasé, you know, you're just as dead as if you've been murdered with a knife as you are if you've been murdered with a firearm. And that comes from a guy early in my career. I went to several homicides and suicides, and when I was the editor of a weekly newspaper, and they were all tragic, but I didn't see much difference between the way they were investigated. The police would be there, the medical examiner would show up, and those people all died. And you know that's the unfortunate part of all of this is that somebody, some innocent person, could be killed either with a knife or a gun or blunt instruments. If you look at again the FBI uniform crime reports, you'll find that in any given year, more people are fatally stabbed or slashed to death than are killed with either rifles or shotguns of any given type. you find typically more people who are murdered with fists, feet, or by strangulation, hands, than are killed with rifles or shotguns. And, blunt instruments are also responsible for more homicides than rifles or shotguns. And that's the FBI talking, not me. I don't make up those figures. They report them every year, usually in late September.
So are you saying that guns are unfairly ferreted out or unfairly maligned for public damage, for damage against human beings?
Well, I think that people get the impression that guns are the problem, where the problem really is with the person who uses the weapon, no matter what weapon it is. We demonize the tool and not the fool, the person who uses it to commit mayhem. I think that's something that we as a society are probably going to have to deal with a little more firmly than maybe we have. We've got to have certainty of punishment. We can't just arrest people and take guns away from them and then kick them loose after they've done 6 months or get a suspended sentence. There was a report just the other day, and I wrote about this, out of Wenatchee, early in May or in late April. A guy was arrested over there, a 13-time convicted felon. This guy had shot himself in the privates with a gun that he shouldn't have had. When he got to the hospital, he dropped a balloon full of marijuana. The investigating officers found that he had some methamphetamines in his car. They issued a warrant for his arrest. He turned himself in. When they stripped him and searched him in the jail, he had some marijuana again in a balloon. And this guy should not have had a firearm, and yet he did. Well, if somebody's committed 13 felonies, I don't care what kind of felonies they are, but that level, that number of felonies, you ought to be in jail for a long, long time, not running around out there someplace with a gun that you shouldn't have had. So I'm not really sure where we want to go with this, except that we need to get a little more harsh with the people who break the law and just leave the law-abiding citizens alone.
Let's talk about domestic violence situations, because domestic violence is a pretty risky thing for a woman. And I am saying women, I'll get all these men who come in and talk about, yeah, but men happen to. Yes, it does. It does happen to men. But the overwhelming majority of domestic violence in this country is male on female. And so let's talk about those situations. If they are arrested for domestic violence, their weapons are taken away like that, right?
I beg your pardon?
If somebody is arrested for domestic violence, the police take away their weapons, do they not? Or does that?
Yeah, there are laws at both the state and federal levels regarding domestic violence offenders. Under federal law, if you've been convicted of domestic violence, you can't have a firearm or actually even ammunition. And of course, there are state laws that go right along with that. They follow along the same principle. That is a given, and I think there's a problem with the way people might misunderstand sometimes what happens in any kind of arrest situation where, the police respond under certain laws. They're supposed to arrest somebody, take them away. They're supposed to take the guns away. If the individual gets back out and the victim has been essentially disarmed too, how is she going to protect herself? We've seen this sort of thing happen in the past where somebody is arrested, they're taken away for, you know, 72 hours or however long it is, and then they are released, a piece of paper isn't going to really prevent them from going back and maybe getting revenge or something. And you know, you could have a long conversation with people in police department domestic violence units about that, because this is not anything new. If you're going to arrest somebody and charge them with a crime, especially a violent crime, I'm not too sure that the public good is going to be benefiting from the fact that they get released, you know, on personal recognizance or however that works, depending on what state you're in. You know, you've got to pay attention to that sort of thing. Again, we have to recognize that a person in the United States under our justice system is presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. You know, I'm not an attorney. I'm certainly not a prosecutor or a defense attorney. And there's a very real and sensitive balancing act that goes along there. We have to pay attention to everybody's rights, which sometimes that's good or bad. I don't know, but I leave that to somebody else to determine. I just write about this stuff, and you know, I've seen some of the results of this on both sides.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that for every statement that you're making about it, it's not, you know, the guns that harm people; it's the fools that harm people. You know, that kind of thing. We've heard these arguments before, and yet there's still, every time there's some notorious situation where somebody kills somebody with a gun, we just get inundated with information about how evil guns are and how we have to get rid of them. Why? Why?
Well,
you know, I understand that I'm asking a question that probably has a much deeper answer than what we're talking about right here, but why? Why are we so convinced? I mean, if my neighbor gets in a car wreck and his family dies or a member of his family dies, I don't see anybody talking about let's get rid of all the cars.
Well, yeah, I think you just cracked a code there. You know, I'm not a psychologist either, and I did poorly in psychology in college. I found that I could write better than I could analyze somebody, but seriously, I think, you know, we're going back to what we talked about earlier. We've got this public perception that has, I think, evolved over time, that guns have been demonized by people who don't like firearms, by the media that doesn't understand firearms, by politicians who really don't care for the idea of answering or being held responsible for violating the rights of a lot of their constituents. And if I had the time, which I don't, I don't think any of us do, you know, we could sit down and maybe analyze why this is happening. You know, there are no easy answers to this. And I've been around long enough to get that much, at least. There are no easy answers to preventing any kind of violent crime, whether it's domestic violence or robbing banks or shooting up a school. There really aren't any easy answers. And for somebody to suggest that the panacea is one more gun law, that's just delusional, not only on the part of the person making the proposal, but on the people who believe that. Because it's just not going to work. You're not going to be able to prevent every crime. And the downside of trying to is that you punish a lot of people who never would have committed a crime in the first place. And again, you're eroding what is a protected right as opposed to regulating a privilege. And we've got to be very, very careful about protecting people's rights because, say, for instance, we reached a point in history where the government said, hey, you know, we're going to erase the Second Amendment. There is really nothing stopping the government from coming after the First Amendment, and trust me, they would, because I think we've seen in the past that not just guns, but a free press is a threat to a tyrannical government of any kind. And, you know, I think history has shown us that when we have government overthrows in other countries, the first thing they do is they rush to control the press. And if you happen to be a member of the press that's saying something that new government doesn't like, you're in a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. Well, and I think you've touched on something else here, too, because I think that you're familiar with the phrase citizen journalist.
Oh, yeah. I know a lot of citizen journalists.
Well, a lot of people may not be familiar with that. And when I was trained as a journalist, there were ethics. I mean, ethics, and there was accountability, and you didn't publish a story, that, especially one that was controversial, unless you had at least a couple of confirmations, a couple of different sources saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
With the advent of media and cell phones, the current media and cell phones, et cetera, anyone with a cell phone can be a journalist. They can take a picture. They can post it online. It gets millions and if not billions of views, and people absorb that information as if it had the same verifiable and sources as the New York Times. And it
well,
doesn't.
I think
it
you
that.
No, you're right. I think you've touched on something that. Because of the evolution of communications in this country, we need to be more cognizant of the fact that just because you read something on the internet doesn't make it the truth. There are some online publications that print stuff every day. They pull out. Publish stuff every day, not print, but publish stuff every day, that I never use them as a source for any kind of information. I just won't, because they've demonstrated in the past how unreliable they are and inaccurate they are. And, you know, I'm not going to name names, but if you read my stuff, I provide links online stuff that I publish, and those links go to reputable and reliable sources. I would quote the New York Times because, contrary to what a lot of people think, you know, it's still a reputable newspaper. I mean, it is a well-established source. But somebody's blog, and I see this way too often, that you can read something online that all they quote is somebody else's blog that has quoted somebody else's blog, and it becomes just a lot of hearsay. Back when I got out of J school and had my first job as a weekly newspaper editor, I established for myself a two-source rule. If I had something, especially something that might be explosive in its nature, I'd always get confirmation from a second source, an independent source. And you've got to do that if you're going to have any credibility at all. And, you know, we live in such a litigious society that you got to take that extra care or you risk being sued. I've had to correct a couple of things in print over the years, and I'm not sorry that I had to do that because it helps clear the air. It certainly, I think, reinforces the notion that I try to be accurate, and I've seen other reporters do the same thing, and good for them. At the end of the day, anybody in journalism, all we've got going for us is credibility. And if we lose that credibility, it's very difficult and sometimes impossible to regain that, to regain the trust of our readers, and in broadcast journalism, to regain the trust of our listeners. So we got to be really careful about that. And I think most reporters are really careful. They care about what they write or report. At least I'd like to think so. I know some really damn good reporters that I don't agree with anything, you know, on in terms of whatever we're talking about beyond the weather, maybe. But you know, politically, we don't see eye to eye on anything. But I know that they are very meticulous about trying to be accurate, and that's really what counts in this business.
Well, what I was getting to kind of roundabout here is that with the how inundated the public is, all of us are, with information, whether it's accurate, whether it's been verified, we are just inundated with information. I don't think I know, I'm trying to say this gently, I don't know a huge number of people who see the difference. If they read it on the internet, it is gospel. It is just as true as anything else. What I'm thinking of about the issues about gun control is we are in a society that is getting inundated with information that may or may not be accurate, and we are jumping to make rules, laws, et cetera, about, based on that information. And I'm wondering if that's what we're doing with gun laws. We're jumping on some sort of bandwagon, whether it's legitimate or not. And once we get the idea from all this input that guns are bad, guns are horrible, then nobody can see a good reason to have a gun. And I think your issue, the constitutional right, which is so significant, I think there are not a lot of lay people out there who really care. I had a professor once who said, we're all willing to give up rights that we're not using. And I think I see that in the issue of gun control and gun laws. We get inaccurate information or partial information. It inflames us. You know, I mean, do we really think that there will never again be a school massacre if we somehow can remove all the guns from, you know, make enough laws to remove guns from, you know, because, I mean, it is true that the people who are going to break the law are going to break the law, whether it's about the speed limit or about a gun. So we're making these laws and these rules. And I'm not so naive as to say we shouldn't have any of those. Of course we should. But, I mean, I don't want my neighbor to have a tank and a flamethrower next door. I really don't. But I think that we are basing all of this panic and all of this terror and all of this zeal to restrict guns based on inaccurate, partial, and incomplete information with no consideration of the fact that, wait a minute, as you pointed out, this isn't a privilege. Our country was started with a set of rules, and that set of rules says, boom, the second of the Ten Amendments says we get to have a right to bear arms. So am I just full of hot air here, or do you see merit in what I'm saying? And when you answer that, then I'm going to ask you what we can do about it.
Well, yeah, I see a lot of merit in what you're saying. In fact, I'll tell you what, you're probably going to get some emails from people who will claim, hey, you've been listening to that crazy guy Workman too much. We don't like you anymore. But in all seriousness, yeah, I think that we have reached a point where too many people do act on just partial information or completely spurious information, just specious stuff, just stuff that makes no sense at all, that they just seem to agree with it because, hey, it sounds good, and I've always believed that, so this must be right. As far as that being a recent thing, I don't know. You'd have to probably contact somebody that listened to Orson Welles' War of the Worlds to see what kind of a panic that caused back in the 1930s. You know, my God, people were actually believing that we'd been invaded by green people from Mars. It was just, and it set off a lot of alarms with a lot of people. And I'm not saying that people are gullible, but they may be a little too easy to, and this is kind of a pun, but to jump the gun on some of this stuff. As far as owning a tank or a flamethrower, you know, Paul Allen, the late Paul Allen, who helped finance Initiative 1639, it's my understanding that he actually owned a tank. He bought a surplus tank, I think it was a German tank. I saw that widely reported here a few years ago. I know people who own machine guns. I've known people who own machine guns. They've never committed a crime with any of them. They don't live in Washington State, where we live, but they have annual competitions with these things. They can afford ammunition more than I can, evidently, because they burn up a lot of it. But they get together and they have good times, and people collect these things. They do it harmlessly, except for the noise, maybe. But I understand why a lot of people who never grew up around guns, who their only experience with guns has either been seeing crime victims or crime in their neighborhoods or watching movies, and it scares them. They're afraid of evil black-looking guns like the AR-15, but they're less afraid of somebody walking around with a higher-powered bolt-action rifle that they used to hunt elk or deer with. Sometimes there's no rhyme or reason to that thinking, but I think they have a perception problem more than anything, that there's more than 100 million people in this country, by some estimates, who own firearms. And I think privately, firearms ownership, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 million to 500 million guns. You're not going to ban those things. You're never going to get rid of them. This utopian idea that if we just get rid of all the guns, we're all going to be able to sit around and sing guitar songs and hug each other into a better feeling. And that's a nice fantasy world, but I happen to live in the real one. And even today, as I said earlier, I think the Second Amendment is just as important as it was when it was ratified as part of the Constitution back in the 1780s. We still have maybe not marauding bands of wild savages or outlaws robbing stagecoaches, but we do have home invasion robberies. We've got people who try to mug other people, people who try to commit rape, kidnap children. There are all kinds of reasons, legitimate reasons, for somebody to have a firearm for personal protection in this country. And we need to be very protective of that right, because the oldest human right, I'm not talking about civil rights, the oldest human right is the right of self-preservation. And there are times when if you need to defend your life with lethal force, you better have the tools there to do it.
Well, I want to jump back a little bit to the domestic violence situation, because that's a situation, I work in the domestic violence field, and that's where I want to. Mm-hmm. And I'm not so sure. I understand what you're saying about, well, if the guns are confiscated in a DV situation, you know, then he gets out of jail and he goes back and now she doesn't have a gun. I'm not sure I buy that, because I've seen a lot of studies that show that women are reluctant to use guns more so than men are anyway. And, you know, so I'm not willing to poo-poo you, but I'm thinking, I'm not sure I really buy into that one. But the fact
Well, see, there you go with the perception. See, you have a a conclusion, or you've reached a conclusion that maybe I said something you disagree with. Well, you know, we live in the United States. You can disagree with me all you want to. There are probably other studies, and certainly there are some case histories that they may be anecdotal in nature, but I fall back on something that the gun control crowd likes to repeat all the time. If it saves just one life, then it's worth it. Well, if it saved just one life to have a firearm in the hands of somebody who's been a victim of domestic violence or could be a victim of domestic violence, if it saves her life, you know, I'm not going to stand here and say that's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not saying it's a bad idea, and I'm not saying that you're not accurate. I'm saying I'm not sure I am fully behind you and supportive of that statement, in my opinion. But it remains a huge issue when truly abusive people, dangerous people, have firearms. And I think that what you were referring to as the gun control crowd thinks that if we can eliminate weaponry in general, if we can eliminate guns in general, I don't think they really care about all weapons, just guns, that somehow or other that will take care of the problem. I don't think so. I mean, I would imagine that there are plenty of people who've been, you know, hit with rocks or frying pans, and, you know, grant you, you're not going to wipe out as many people with a knife or a frying pan as you will with a, you know, some sort of Uzi. So that is a legitimate argument, but the fact remains that these mass shootings are really few and far between.
Well, they really are, yeah.
Yeah, that's hard for somebody, you know, whose kid might have been in a school shooting.
Look, you know, one journalist talking to another, mass shootings or mass stabbings for that matter, and I've read about instances that have happened over in China where, you know, 47 people get stabbed to death until they get a bad guy. That stuff happens to be news, and the definition of news is really includes stuff that doesn't happen every 10 minutes. It's news because it's A, sensational, B, it's unusual, and it does have a lot of public interest. It grabs the public's attention. And something like a mass shooting or a bombing of some sort that costs a lot of life or creates a lot of mayhem, that is news. And people will always be interested in it. It doesn't mean that we all need to be afraid of that it's going to happen next week or tomorrow on in your neighborhood. I guess that's what makes it news, but it does mean that we pay attention to this sort of thing. We try to, at the end of the day, try to do the right thing by everybody, but still there's a sensational aspect to that kind of a story. And, you know, I learned way back in J school that sensationalism sells a lot more than Joe's bake sale on Saturday. You know, that's worth maybe a paragraph or two in a weekly newspaper. But, you know, a mass shooting or a mass stabbing or a plane crash, anything that is going to grab the public's attention, that's news. And I guess that's why you always see that on the front page above the fold, and it's always the lead story at the 6 o'clock news.
I used to tell my children they call it news, they don't call it everyday, you know, or ordinary.
Yeah.
They call it news because there's something different and unusual about it. And I think you're right. And I think that because going back to my silly little premise about how we're inundated with information that may or may not be accurate, I think it's the same thing with the news. We're inundated with this news. We think it happens all the time. I'm a big one on the studies. And, you know, one of the studies that really opened my eyes was they did a study with New York Times, which we recognize as being pretty reasonable and accurate. And they had the control group read the New York Times. The other group read the exact same stories, but they did it online. They read the exact same words, but it was online. And then they gave them each questionnaires to fill out about how reliable do they think what they read was. And the people, the group that read it online, overwhelmingly thought it was more reliable than the people who read it in the newspaper. And I
Well, what did that tell you?
That tells me that we're gullible and that we will absorb this information a lot more readily than we're not skeptical enough. We're not skeptical enough. I mean, if we read if we open our Facebook thing and we go to the news or somebody posted something, then by golly, we believe it 100%. You know, we just do. And it's not necessarily so. And I think that, the gun control issue is particularly vulnerable to that phenomenon. So that's me. And yet somehow, even with all that lofty thinking, Dave, I am just poor as a church mouse. Go figure. how can that possibly be? But,
well, when you figure it out, you tell me so we'll both know.
Okay. But when I initially contacted you, I said, I want to have just a reasonable discussion. I don't want to vilify. I don't want to make assumptions. I don't want to, do all of that stuff that's normally done with this issue. And I
Well, how'd that work out for you?
Well, other than my personal jumping to conclusions and my personal assumption, I think we did pretty well. What do you think?
It's been an enjoyable way to burn up a little time in an afternoon. So.
But boy, burn me with faint praise there. Well, it was better than cleaning out the refrigerator, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I'm not gonna jump into that one because bang, I'll wind up having to do that. So.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to make sure we had a little bit of time for is, what's the solution to this? Is this a problem where we need a solution? I think you and I can both agree that it is. I mean, look at our Washington State initiative, where there's a problem here regarding the perception of guns and what they can do, but also regarding what we as a society should be doing about it.
Well, you used a word just a minute ago that I think is part of the solution, and the word is skepticism. I was a skeptic. I mean, it kind of goes with the territory. When you're a journalist, you got to ask questions. Sometimes you're going to get answers that you really think are just bogus, but you got to ask those questions anyway. And I think the public that votes just blindly for gun control, they're not skeptical enough about the motives behind some of these issues, and maybe they don't ask the questions. They just reflexively vote because I don't like guns. And I think the same might go with somebody at the other end of the spectrum too. I'm not really keen on the idea of, like you said, everybody owning a tank or a flamethrower, although people own them, they haven't hurt anybody. And as I said earlier, if I found a guy, one of my neighbors, if he had a house full of guns, I wouldn't care if he was responsible for them and responsible with them. But we've got to be skeptical about what the gun control people are advocating and what they think we're going to accomplish with some of these things. And I've seen that in my experience anyway, gun control, the extreme gun control laws haven't accomplished anything unless the idea is to penalize law-abiding citizens. If you look at the number of homicides that occur every year, and even the number of shootings, non-fatal shootings that occur every year, that really represents a fraction of the gun owners out there and the guns that they own. And again, that's not me talking, that's the FBI data. So the solution, once I crack that code, I'll share it with the world, because I don't know what the solution really is. I've lived long enough to realize that my idea about how to deal with problems may not be shared by somebody living in another town or at the other end of a telephone. My ideas, maybe they work for me in my perspective, but they won't work for somebody else. And there's always going to be somebody who disagrees, who says, "No, you know, I got a better idea. Well, let's try this." And I, you know, I'm willing to listen to that sort of thing, up to the point that it starts infringing on the rights of law-abiding citizens. I would never just endorse the idea of turning a microphone off for somebody because I didn't like him, because I think he's nuts. You know, I'll let him prove that to the world just by letting him talk. I wouldn't stand by for a heartbeat and allow somebody to be prohibited from writing his or her opinion in print, you know, for everybody to see. We've all got ideas. Some of them are a little kooky sometimes, and, you know, that includes probably me and maybe you too. I don't know. But I fall back on the principle of an old friend of mine who passed away, Ray Carter, who used to work at the Second Amendment Foundation. And we were talking one day, and he said, "You know, if it makes me giggle, it's probably a bad idea." And you've got to use that perspective sometimes to maybe find a solution, to be skeptical, and to be willing to say, "Hey, you know, just because I can do it doesn't mean I should." Yeah. And just because I might believe it doesn't mean I really ought to believe it. So I guess that's where we're at.
Okay. Well, I'll go along with that. I think that is where we're at. I think that I've enjoyed this conversation, and I should let folks know that I am not an anti-gun advocate at all. I mean, I'm very against having bad people have guns and weapons.
So am I.
But I can't think of too many people who would say, yeah, let's make sure Hitler's well armed. I think that for me, I every now and then will go to the gun range and target shoot. I like that, and I'm pretty good at it. We grew up on a farm, and so we always had the 22 rifle. Never had handguns, but we had the 22 rifle and a shotgun, and we used them not to kill living things. I mean, I think there were a couple of occasions where an animal had to be put down, and my dad would do that. But we would put bales of hay, against the barn wall, and we would target shoot, and it's fun. It is fun. It is no less fun than playing your video games. As long as I'm saying this, I'm going to tell you my deep-held private secret. This is you're the first person I've said this to, but do you know how they have the wild pigs down in Texas that are doing so much damage?
Yeah.
They have helicopter shoots of the wild pigs. I have never hunted a living thing. Never really appealed to me, but by gummy, I would love to do one of those helicopter hunts of the wild pigs, and then they dress them out for you. You can take it home and put them in your freezer. Doesn't that sound like fun?
Well, it sounds a little exotic for me and probably more expensive than I can afford, but I've seen the videos of them. You know, there are actual videos floating around of these helicopter shoots, and you know, a lot of people will say, "Oh my God, they can't do that." But if you look at what these wild pigs and picaris and javelinas and, you know, whatever else they call them, the damage that they are doing to croplands, they got to get rid of them.
Well, and to people too, they harm people. So anyway, so that's one of my that's my little deep secret. You can send it's Heather.Stark at 3Women3Ways. I've never shot a living human or a living thing, but I think I could do that. I think I could shoot one of those pigs. So that's my little secret dream.
Well, I expect to be invited to the barbecue.
Okay. If I ever actually get down there and do it, you're going to be the first one I invite.
okay.
Thank you so much, David Workman. I really appreciated having this conversation about guns and the Second Amendment and the Second Amendment Foundation. If people want more information, either from you or from the Second Amendment Foundation, who can they go to?
Well, it's easy to find SAF. It's SAF.org. And you can also plug into the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms at ccrkba.org. And you can find my screed every day at Liberty Park Press, the Conservative Firing Line. I do a weekly online column for American Handgunner called Insider Online. You'll find my byline occasionally in Concealed Carry Handguns. I write a monthly column for Guns Magazine on firearms rights. And I'm the senior editor of thegunmag.com, which used to be Gun Week. And if you can figure out when I find time to sleep or relax, send me an email so that I know.
Well, I sent you an email at 2:08 in the morning on Sunday, and you didn't even see it, so you must have been sleeping then. Thank you so much. I appreciated the conversation. You'll have to come back sometime. Keep us informed about what's happening with Initiative 1639 in Washington State. I would like to know. Thank you,
okay.
And thank you for listening to Three Women, Three Ways. Join us next week.